teacher was trying. The president of the organization came back and the dining room was full of people, and he yelled at her. He said, "Never, never are you to serve that again." The poor woman was just so upset, and I thought, I don't think I want to work here if that's the way they treat the people who work here. I just thought that was terrible.
Was this early when you'd, soon after you'd gone?
Soon
after you'd gone to work there?
Yes, soon after I'd gone to work there. Well, this professor was, he was a very nice person. He was, but he just jumped all over everybody for a long time. But I watched him age, and he got very mellow at the end.
Can you tell me who he was?
It was J. Howard Matthews of the chemistry department.
Well, I'm glad he mellowed.
But he was a good friend of mine anyway. But I just couldn't understand how anybody could treat a woman that way.
How was purchasing of food handled?
It was handled through the manager, through different companies in town. We purchased a great deal of meat in the early days from the Gayden Company, and they still are in sort of in business.
Was
now.
The fish company that same? Same company.
And we bought lots of things from Frank's and Simon's. And, but it was, we just purchased our stuff from week to week or day to day just as it came around. And charged it, and sometimes that was one of our big problems because the bills weren't being paid. And I know in 1935 when a new manager came in, he came from the union, and he was an accountant, and he was a very good businessman, and he took over all these debts and got them all paid off and everything. But
that must have been a relief.
Yes, but it's always been a very difficult situation down there because people belonging to the club didn't feel like they wanted to spend a lot of money for food. I don't know what some of them would do if they were around today, see what prices of food are. Of course, I know that salaries are much higher now too, but people didn't have an awfully lot of money, I guess, in those days.
Well, certainly not during the Depression years.
No, and that was about the time I had started down there, and that's when the time was so very, very rough. And salaries were low. And the students were getting 20 and 25 cents an hour. And trying to put themselves through school. Remember, we had one person working at the desk. I felt so sorry for him because he was self-supporting. He had one pair of shoes and they had a big hole in the sole, and those were the only shoes he had. But he put himself through medical school.
And my word.
I always have so much admiration whenever I think of him.
Do you remember his name?
That was Jim Grindell.
Jim Grindell.
Mm-hmm. But in those days, people worked very hard, and students didn't have very much money, and they lived very sparsely. I think at that time, our rooms in the club, they started at $15 a month, and they ran up to about $35 a month, and that included their maid service and linens and bathroom, for instance, and everything.
How was laundry handled?
The Quality Laundry did our laundry for years and years and years while they were in business. We had a lot of laundry sent out. It was all done outside.
Yes, because you would have had dining room linens as well as housekeeping linens.
Yes, when you think of, you have linens, all twin beds, and you had two sheets for every bed, and went into the laundry. And face towels and hand towels, and for many, many years, up I would say until 1960, we still had linen tablecloths and linen napkins in the dining room, white ones. But then about that time we started using paper napkins. But when I left there in 1979, we were still using linen tablecloths in the dining room, white linen ones.
They do look nice.
They do. They sort of give an elegance to a place that just can't do it with colored tablecloths. You can't do it with paper tablecloths or even bare ones. But there's something about it that makes it quite elegant.
Did you find that paper napkins were less expensive
yes.
than maintaining linen
yes,
ones?
Yes, they were. And another thing, our napkins were wearing out, and it was getting to be rather difficult and very, very expensive to get new ones all the time. And the laundry is hard on linens. And I don't know what they're doing now, because even when I was down there, I was mending linens all the time just to keep them usable.
You yourself were doing this?
Mm-hmm. I was doing it on the machine, and I had never done anything like that before, but I knew we just couldn't afford to buy any, and so I'd make smaller ones out of the great big ones and hem them up and use them that way. You know, when you have to, you can do an awful lot of things to keep a place going.
Yes, I guess.
I'd ask my friends for draperies for some of the rooms there.
How about the rooms that were lived in? Did you have draperies there?
Yes. We had draperies there and...
Carpets?
Not wall-to-wall carpets, but every room had some kind of a carpet in, and we bought them at some of the furniture stores when they were having sales, and they weren't nearly as expensive, but all the floors in the club were cement and painted.
Even the upper floors?
Yes. It's a very, very well-built building. There are no wooden floors that I know of there. Everything has up in the main dining room and the reading room, they were all terrazzo floors. And they were cement floors or all through the building.
Mm.
The walls are very good. They're very soundproof too, just thick walls. You don't find a building like that very often.
Well, I guess not.
Oh, it's such a beautiful building it was. I think. Of course, I'm prejudiced having been down there so long, and it was just my whole life.
When did you become manager instead of receptionist?
Well, I don't remember when it was. Our bookkeeper we'd had for many years left the city, and the manager at that time asked me if I would take over, do part of the bookkeeping, and I said I wasn't very happy about it because I would miss having the contact with the people, but I said if you have someone to do the back of the bookkeeping, the accounting and making out the statements, and let me keep part of my job, otherwise I think I would do it. And so I took that over. And this was about, shortly after World War II. In World War II, when everybody was called, so many people were called into service, our manager at that time, was called in, and he left the club in charge of the three women, the bookkeeper and the dietitian and myself. We each had our duties to do, and then we had the board of directors that we could call on to help us through
What were the names of the other two?
Leonora Jacobson.
And she was?
The bookkeeper. And Genevieve Sawdy, Sawdy, was the dietitian.
So the three of you really ran things for a time.
While he was in service, yes. But it was very rough on us, I think everybody, because we couldn't get much student help, especially boys, and we hadn't had very many women, girls, waiting on tables, because it was rather hard for them. I think I was carrying up trays at that time when I was 38 years old, never waited on a table, and never carried a big, heavy tray, and I was trying to do that and do my job. But we all pitched in. You can do that when you have to.
Now, somewhere I learned, I think, that that there was something about members moving out during World War II and because of the men in the Army student training program.
Mm-hmm. The university decided they needed that space for these trainees, ASTP. Isn't that what it is?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we gave our people 48 hours notice.
Oh.
Now, the rooms were not all filled at that time because that was the period when a lot of the people who would have been in the club had already gone to service. But I can't remember how long they were out, but that was all the notice they had been given, and these people had to scram for rooms, I'll tell you, to find some place to live. And so they did some small job of renovating up there because every single room had two people in and every double room had four people in.
For the Army.
And they took out all the phones.
Mm-hmm.
And these people were not permitted to use any of our facilities. I mean, going in our front door, they had to go in the back door.
They couldn't use the dining room or those areas?
No, because they had their mess wherever it was. Uh-huh. And, that's what happened. And so they were there for, I don't know whether how many months it was or not. We just had this one sort of batch. Then they had the offices in the back on the main floor, where there were the ladies' lounge. They took that over.
The present ladies' lounge?
No, the ladies' lounge, it's in the rear. Haven't you ever been there?
In the other section?
Uh-huh.
Down no, there. I haven't been there.
Uh-huh. There are two rooms down there. It used to be, they had a woman managers, and they used to have those two, had two-room suite. They had two rooms and a sort of a bath, and that's where they lived. But after, I think it was Dora Bush left, they used that for a room for two or three tables of bridge, or women wanted to come in and talk or just to relax and read. And it's being used now, I think, for little dining rooms and used for committee meetings at back lounges. But that's where the commanding officers had their office. So they took over there. That was quite a change for the club to have all these fellows in there. Instead of having 100 people there, they were having 200 people living in the place. It was rather rough on the building, too.
I would suppose. Who provided the extra beds?
The university.
Oh, they did. This didn't come out of club funds.
No. Uh-uh. No, and then I think that the university, after they moved out, they renovated it, painted it and everything, took care of it so it was livable again for university people. But it was rather hard on it, have all those people in there and using all the bathrooms and everything, twice as many as we had expected to. Yes. I think maybe it was after that, too, that we had one of the music clinics. Students lived there for a summer before they turned it over to the club. So that was used for that, too. You know, in the First World War, I wasn't there, but in the First World War, they used it for a hospital.
They did.
Mm-hmm. Because there were so many flu patients, and they couldn't accommodate them at the hospitals at that time.
That's right. There was a big flu epidemic.
Mm-hmm. It was very, very bad. And so that, I was told that it was being used for a hospital. I don't know what happened then. That was in 1919. You see, the club was built, I think they started the club in 1907, and they started to build in 1908. And I think they built it in three different times, so by the end of 22 or 23, the club as it is was built.
Well,
and I think that's the reason why it's sort of built in two sections, why you can't go through in part of it.
Well, there's a frame section early on, I've read.
Uh-huh.
And that was...
It was built around. The first section was built around this little house that was out there.
Which later came down.
Uh-huh, which later came down. And then they put the rest of the porch on, or whatever they did. I don't know. I've never seen any yes, I have. There are pictures of the building with a house there. Probably.
I've seen, uh-huh. Not recently, but I have seen uh-huh. some myself. Well, the music clinic wouldn't have been as large a group as
the army
group.
But there were students, young students in there. One time, I don't think there was anything else used for the club in such a number of it until the offices came in, the hospital, and the ASTP, and that very short span when they had the group from the music school, younger children, or young people, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing we haven't talked about that I've heard of from other people I've interviewed is the question of blacks. And I gather they were not allowed. And there's a celebrated case of someone who applied for residence and nobody knew he was black until he'd come. What can you tell me about that affair?
I sort of hate to have you bring that up.
Well, it's a very sad historical situation.
This happened during World War II, and a great many of our rooms were rented by mail. And I had a young man had applied for a room there, and he was a graduate student. Probably at that time, I was not aware or was not educated that much to know that some of the universities were mostly black, and I think he wrote a letter from Howard University, or at least I found out later that he was from there. I'm not sure. And so I wrote him a letter and told him that we would be happy to accommodate him, and that we didn't have a single room at the time, but if he would live with somebody else, I think we could accommodate him in a half a double. And I said, if you want to get in touch with, or maybe this was later. And so he wrote back and accepted the offer. I had assigned him to a room with another person, but whether or not he ever got in contact with him, I don't know. That night, when he arrived for his room, a person was at the desk, and this was the first time that I know of that anybody who would ever ask for a room was black. And he came in. This person was rather shocked to see him, and she immediately called the House Committee Chairman to come down, because this was an unheard of thing, and they didn't think they could accommodate him. And so he came down, and they were terribly upset. And whether he asked him to leave that night or not, I don't know. But he did ask him to leave, and he moved out. And there were protests, not like they are today, but people were up in arms, especially the people who were more liberal than some of the people at the university at that time. And they had a membership meeting, and they had lots of letters were sent in to the board. And there was nothing in the Constitution or bylaws that I remember that said that no one but a white person could live there, or no blacks could live there. But anyway, there wasn't anything in our membership rules. But they, at that time, after a heated meeting, they decided to take a vote and accept blacks as members of the club. They invited him to come back. I think he did, but not that semester. I think he did later. And it was a real embarrassment for everybody. The letter I had written to this gentleman was published in the Capital Times, as you know it would be. And an article was in the Time magazine.
Oh.
And there was a great deal to do about it. And I felt terribly embarrassed because even though I didn't know he was black, I had no reason not to take him. I would have taken him if I had known he was black. Nobody told me I couldn't. And
there just wasn't any precedent for this.
There wasn't any precedent, and it was just too bad. I felt so sorry for this person when I found out about it. I don't know what I would have done if he'd come in when I was there alone. And you see, we had no manager at that time because he was in service.
And you were still in the role of receptionist?
Yes, at that time. And I had rented the room to him by mail, see. And I think that the House Committee Chairman was very biased, too. He was prejudiced against him. And I think that was another reason.
Well, I've been told that some members of the faculty got quite exercised about
this.
They
did. Yes, they did. Many of them. Since that time, we've had a number of black people. I mean, there's been no reason for it. But the funny part about it, of course, nobody knew this either, and I didn't know it for a while either, but there was a gentleman living there during three or four summers who was partially black. Nobody ever knew about it.
They didn't realize this?
Uh-huh. And that was at the same time.
Huh.
But was never brought up. And he was very light, never even thought of as black. Or partially black.
Well, the climate of opinion is a little different now,
yes.
At least at
mm-hmm.
the university,
mm-hmm.
I'm glad to say.
Mm-hmm. This man did come back then, I think, maybe two or three years later, and had a room there. I don't know if it was hard on him or not. I talked to him a few times, but I never brought this up because I was really, frankly, very upset about it.
I think a lot of people were upset about it.
But there are still, or were still when I left, there was a lot of correspondence about this.
Still?
Mm-hmm, down at the club.
Why was that?
I mean, no, not then. I mean, the correspondence that we had had at that time. And
the
newspaper,
I see.
And the people who had written in letters about the way we had handled it.
Oh, I see.
And that sort, yeah. So there should be something like that on file. But it was a history-making event, and very embarrassing for a lot of us.
Now, his name was Arthur Burke, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd have some of this information from Merle Curdy.
I was going to say, I bet Merle Curdy was one of them.
Yes, he told me that he and Helen White together and...
Lydia Bascom.
Yes, Elizabeth Brandeis.
Yes.
Paul Clark.
Uh-huh.
Ray Agard.
Oh, yes,
these are all names that that he mm-hmm. mentioned in connection with this,
mm-hmm.
this incident. Well, of course, it made it a bit easier. I mean, once the decision had been made that it was all right to have
yes.
blacks, it must have made it easier for visiting or people coming for a semester or so to
mm-hmm.
find lodgings there.
Mm-hmm. I think at one time, too, they had the Green Pastures cast of that play, and they were black. And they came to Madison, and I can't remember if they stayed there or not. And I don't remember what in the time of it was. But they fed them, but they didn't feed them in the main dining room. They fed them in a separate dining room.
Where are these other dining rooms?
Or is there
just one?
No, there are two. Well, there's the John R. Commons room right back at the main dining room. Nice little room we call the Blue Room, and then they've been using the ladies' lounge in the rear for dining room. Then downstairs, they have what they call the Mermaid Room, which used to be the billiard room and a breakfast room, the card room. And you could go down there from the stairway in the front going down. But then they boarded that room up later, and so they'd have to go down around. It was used as sort of a rascal room, and I think they're using it now for that. And then there's a large banquet room downstairs, too.
Oh, I didn't realize mm-hmm. all this.
Mm-hmm. So we accommodated private parties down in the banquet room. They used to serve breakfast down there. They used to serve breakfast in the card room. And we often used the banquet room downstairs in the summertime because we had a fan. We could put a fan down there and cool it off. We haven't always had air conditioning.
Well, some places still don't.
I know that. There's no air conditioning there wasn't any air conditioning in the men's rooms upstairs either.
Mm-hmm.
And people were living there on the fourth floor all summer yeah. long. It was very, very hot.
I know. What can you tell me about the proposal that I understand was made at one time to move the University Club to the top of Helen White Hall?
There was just some talk of it. I don't think it went very far. They were wondering at one time whether or not we could find money and could, if we could build there or take over the old observatory hill building up there.
Oh, the old observatory up at
mm-hmm.
the top of the hill?
There was a lot of talk. People wanted to get into that, either renovated or build a place up there. Of course, there's no money anyplace. And they wanted to, I don't know, there were a lot of people had such very, very big ideas on these things, but you just had to have money to do something like that. We couldn't sell the building because the building really didn't belong to us.
How about the land?
Well, the land wouldn't belong to us either then, would it? Because if it had been given to the university, I suppose the land would have gone with that. So the whole bit would have been, and there was nothing in it that we couldn't have gotten enough money to make a down payment on anything. There wasn't much good furniture there. The land is probably very valuable, but we didn't really own it. We were just,
So this was not a financial transaction with the university. They really gave the club to the university.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And with the provision that we could use it as a club until they needed it for other purposes for the university. So this went on for many, many years until 1969, really. The university moved in when they wanted the offices.
So is that when people stopped living there, or when you stopped having very many people there?
Mm-hmm.
And so that the you only kept 8 rooms upstairs for
one
residence?
One wing, and that was on the side, on the Murray Street side. They needed all the rest of it. They would have liked to have had that too, but it was just to the chancellors say so that we could keep that room, those rooms up there.
Now, have they still been kept?
They were the last time I heard.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a bad time then, and if we had not had anybody in the building, I wonder what would have happened to it, even if there weren't anybody there at night during the rioting time. You know, 60, when was that?
It was the late 60s. Food service arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Will you tell me how that came about, what it involved?
Well, we were losing so much money in our food service, and it was so hard to get people who would be willing to work in the dining room and the kitchen areas, especially cooks. And we didn't have a lot of money that cooks were getting, or chefs were getting in other parts. And they didn't want to work a split shift anymore. You see, these people came to work maybe at 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock, and then they'd work until 2 or so, and then they'd have to be back at 4:30 and not get out until 8, and that took so much of their time that it was just getting harder and harder to find people who would be wanting a job like that. And as we were losing more money all the time, it was suggested to our board that maybe we could have our food catered. So we made arrangements with the Wisconsin Union to cater our food, and they, which they did, and then they put in their own help over there, which took it pretty much out of our hands. But we still continued to lose an awfully lot of money. Maybe it was because there was more waste of food. They didn't know how many to plan on, and they couldn't give us a la carte foods like we used to have. We were able to have sandwiches and very many things like that, eggs at noon or whatever for lunches. And so this is what happened. You know, the union took over and they ran the food service. And we always had waiter service before, and they tried it for a while, and it didn't work out because they just couldn't afford to send over that many people to wait on tables. And so we went into a buffet or cafeteria, and many of our people didn't like it because they liked to go over there and sit down and have somebody wait on them. And that's the reason. And until I left, that's what they were doing. Now I think they are doing a little bit in their dining room without the union's help. I don't know how much food they get from the union, but the food the union is not providing all the food service.
Well, one thing I do know is that the menu is different on any given day, so it's not the same as what you have at the union that day.
Mm-hmm.
I have been taken there a couple of times, and it's been quite good, I thought.
And it's all cafeteria or buffet or something like this now?
Yes.
Or they're not waiting on you?
No,
I'm
afraid I'm too late. My days are too late for that kind of service.
But I think it's the economy that did all this to us. And students' wages have to be the minimum. And You have to have quite a number of them to be able to wait on tables. But even at that, when we were having the union, we had people who would come in, and although they would get the food, most of it would be prepared at the union. They had to put it together, fix the salads up, and they had to have quite a number of people there. And they had people coming in to be runners up and downstairs and to fill the buffet table. And we weren't making any money at all from that.
What kind of a financial arrangement did you have with the union?
Well, they were to bill us. When they first took over, then they did our accounts too. But then they found out that that was getting to be too much, so we took the counts back. But they made arrangements to bill us once a month. And we never really made any money at all. And we had to depend on the few rooms that we had and our membership fees to keep us going. And every once in a while we would ask for donations from some of these professors who didn't want to give it up. We sort of have a drive or something like that and get a lot of money in. But it was a very difficult situation. When the university did take over the offices, they said that anybody who was working there at the time, they would see if they could find other places for them to go. So some of the maids and were ready to leave anyway. And we had two or three janitors who were there, and one of them went to work at the hospital, and another became a janitor someplace else. And one of the maids went out to the hospital for a short time and worked, but the rest of them did not take advantage of it. And some of them were older too. We didn't have age discrimination. We had a maid who was working there, I think, until she was in her 80s. She was one of the very faithful, loyal, dependable persons. Rain or shine, she'd come. I don't believe in age discrimination anyway.
No, I agree with you.
I think there are too many people who are let out who still have so much to give.
When did you say that the club became the property of the university?
1933,
the year you came.
Mm-hmm. That was in the offing, but I didn't even know anything about it at that time because I was just out at the desk and nobody would tell me all these things. Board of directors kept things pretty much to themselves and with the manager. But this is what happened. But I don't think there was an awful lot of change then because they kept their dormitory rooms and it kept on going just as it was for many years.
Can you, are there any people that you worked with or who were associated with the club that, or with the board? You recall particularly?
You mean who were members of the club? And
members or board members or
mm-hmm.
people who seem to be more active in club affairs?
Uh-huh. Well, there was always Paul Clark, whom everybody loved, I think. Oh, yeah, I could name so many people. And Mark Ingram has just been one of the backbones of the university club. And Jack Williams in chemistry. And Celia Bascom, Helen White, Charlotte Wood, and old timers. Helen White was such a dear. You know, she always dressed in purples or lavenders or something like that.
I guess I have heard that.
And I asked her one time, you know, she was so very precise and so very proper all the time. I said, why do you always wear purple or lavender? Is it your favorite color? I suppose it is. She said, well, you know, I have to make so many trips. And sometimes I don't have much notice. And so I always have everything that will match. And it's easier to pack. Which I thought. And I thought, why didn't they paint the Helen White building purple?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that have been a nice tribute to her? And, but she was often on committees with men there. But they would be waiting for her. And they'd go in the dining room and sit down, but they wouldn't eat until she came. And I often watched this. She'd come into the dining room. You don't see this happen much anymore. And all the men at the table where she was meeting with would just stand up all at once.
How nice.
There ought to be more of that, hadn't there?
I think so. It would be nice.
But they had so much respect for her. And there was Dean Slichter. And Dean George Sellery. And F.W. Rowe. Some of these very fine people.
Well, there are a couple names you mentioned when I talked to you earlier. One was Carver Pustow.
Oh, yes. He was on the board a lot. And he was one of, I think he's one of the old-time members from way back.
Yeah, he might well have been.
Uh-huh. I don't know how well he is, but I do know that he's still around. But he was on the board for a long time, years ago. And
well, I know he's around. I've interviewed him fairly mm-hmm. recently, so. Mm-hmm.
Harry Glicksman, he was such a dear. He was strange in lots of ways. He used to peel oranges in his room and throw the peelings out the transom in the hallway.
Into the hall?
Into the hall.
And just leave them there?
Oh, sure. People came up clean, would clean them up, but I thought that was strange.
Yes.
And we had a doctor living there at the club one time. I'm not sure if his name was Dr. Levine or not, but he came down the stairs with a new suit. All the tags on them. I think I cut off about 10 or 12 tags before I let him go to work that day. Years ago, you knew almost everybody because most of the heads of the departments, most of the full professors, a lot of associate professors, all came to the club. And you get to see them day after day. And it was such a...
Did you know Phil Fox?
Oh, Phil Fox is one of my favorites. I just love Phil Fox. He was the treasurer of the club for many, many years. And he was very active in anything. And head of the finance department, you always could call him and ask him questions. I remember one time the club had a picnic out at Little Norway. I think it must have been Little Norway that was in existence. A lot of the club members had a picnic out there. And I was brought up where you don't associate members and employees or somebody who is a little different. If you're working for them, you don't have any social or go to social places with them. But Phil Fox asked me to go to this picnic with him one time out there, and I just thought that was really wonderful. Here I was a receptionist, and they'd asked me to go out with him.
Did you go?
Oh, yes, I went. And he was just, they were two very fine people, Phil and his wife. I hated him. After he retired, he didn't keep up with any activities. He came down to the club very few times. he didn't keep up with his dining clubs, and he got to the place that he just wouldn't leave the house.
How do you explain that?
He just wasn't interested in it, and I know his wife said, "I just wish I could get him to go out, but I just can't." Whether or not he felt that he wasn't needed, or he didn't have, he wasn't in with things anymore. Maybe he felt that he just wasn't with the things that were going on. I don't know. But I went out to see him a couple of times. I had some problems with a tax return, and he was sitting in his chair. It was in the afternoon. He had on a robe, and it just read all the time, just sat in his chair and read, never went out. And went up to the nursing home, and then he died not too long ago. That was something else. I was trying to think of some other name that came up just now, and when I was talking about him, but I just guess it slipped my mind.
Well, one name that I have down is Ben Elliott.
Ben Elliott. His wife just died last week.
Yes, I know.
Ben Elliott, I think, is one of the kindest men I've ever known. I enjoyed him so much. And he must be around 90 now, and he's been out as a consultant a lot. I guess he's Mr. Kiwanis himself, too. But he thought the club was very great. He enjoyed people. And I think that's one of the reasons he would always come down there. He didn't play billiards like some of them did who came every day.
Mark Ingram was a billiard player, I think.
And Roe Merle Hefner was, too.
Oh.
He died a couple of years ago.
Something like that.
But he was always the gentleman kind. He always said the right things in the proper fashion, let's put it that way. But if he got mad, you should hear him. He'd storm. He was one, even up until the last few years, he was one person who would come out to the desk and say, "Get that woman out of the reading room."
Elliot would do that?
No. This is Hefner.
Oh, Hefner would.
Hefner did this, No.
Couldn't imagine Ben Elliott doing that.
Oh, no, Ben Elliott. He loved everybody. Mm-hmm. But Hefner was very proper as far as the way you conducted yourself. Anybody was too loud going up the stairs these last few years, any of the people in the offices would make a lot of noise, he'd come right out and say, "Shut up there."
Did he live there?
No, he didn't, but he played billiards every day. He was a good billiard player. And he played with Dean Ingram a lot. I don't know if people on the faculty are like, maybe it's because I'm older too, but people of years ago were different in some ways. Max Otto. Do you ever hear of Max Otto?
Oh, I've heard a lot about him. I never had an opportunity to know him.
He was such a dear. He'd bring me a box of cookies that his wife had made every Christmas from the Otto Bakery, he said it was.
Otto Bakery.
I have a little drawing that he made of himself one time when he was just standing at the desk talking to me. This little caricature I could treasure. That was Henry Kaufman. He played billiards. There's another gentleman. Our professor's different now than they used to be. I know they dress more casually, but...
That's true.
Years ago, professors would always wear white shirts and ties. And
well, perhaps the casual dress sort of goes hand in hand with a more casual manner.
Mm-hmm. We
talked about people getting up when Helen White came into the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
Until she was seated. That sort of thing doesn't happen as
no.
much.
Mm-mm. Sometimes they don't even get up to pull out a chair for a woman. After all, we're liberated, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Supposedly.
But I even up until the last few years, any time I rode on the bus with Dean Ingram, he'd get off the same corner. He'd get off the bus first and hand me down.
How nice. Well, he's
you just
he's
felt
a real
like
gentleman.
A lady all day. Oh, there are so many people crossing my mind all the time. Dr. Harry Kay lived at the university club for years and years and years. He was he was another person who thought the university club was one of the greatest. He was a private physician, but he also was a doctor out at the hospital.
University Hospital?
University Hospital, yeah. He was an excellent heart doctor. And he died in 66, but he was a friend of everyone. He was my mother's doctor, he was my doctor too. And Dr. Shapiro lived there, but I think he's retired. He was the heart man at University Hospitals for many years, but he married and moved out of the club. We had some townspeople living at the club. Walter Ela, whose well-known name in town, was a young lawyer living at the club. And not too many town people lived there, though. But so many people have lived there in the past who have gone on to make a name for themselves. I said, well, if you ever want to do that way, live at the club for a while, it sort of does things to you. When I came down there, I was told I could never call anybody by his first name. And I got to be older, and all of these young people, graduate students who were living in the club, and I'd call them by Mr., and they'd say, why do you call me Mr.? And I said, well, that's what I was told I was to call you. But I think they felt rather important.
Mm-hmm.
That.
You go on doing that until you left?
Oh, yes. It's very difficult for me even now. I would never call Dean Ingram Mark. I never call Ben Elliott Ben. And even many people who are younger than I. I remember not too many years ago, Harry Shuck, he was in the business school professor, and he's retired now. But he said, I wish you would call me Harry. I don't know if you knew him or not.
Did you?
A couple of times. I felt so strange. He was a bachelor and lived up at Kendi Manor. Just going way, way back. I remember a nice incident that happened to me personally. One of the first years I was there, I was entertaining a group of people at my home where I lived with my parents. And this was during the very, very depression period. And no one had any extra money, but these were a group of girls. And one of the professors by the name of Harold Shaw asked the manager if he could send something up for my party. And so he provided the ice cream and a cake and frozen strawberries, which were practically unheard of at that time.
Oh my.
I just couldn't get over that. I thought that was one of the most wonderful things anybody could do for a person who was working there.
Gracious. That's lovely.
I'm always appreciative of anything anybody does for me. Another person who was so good during the World War II, was good to the club and to us, was Oliver Rundle, Dean of the Law School.
Oh, yes.
I could go up there any time during the day with a problem, and he would take the time out to help me make up my mind or a decision or something like that. He was a very kind person, and I think it was hard on him when he had to retire. And Aldo Leopold used to come in so much. I liked him very much, too. Too bad that his life was taken so quickly.
Yes.
He's a great guy. Ernest Bean from the geology department, he's been very well known, was very active in the club. These people generally came to all the dinner parties. All these people came to the dinner parties, or they would have a group as invited guests.
So they were there quite frequently.
Oh, yes. You could always depend on these people to come to a dinner party, dinner lecture, dinner musical especially. And the Andrew Weavers, John Weaver's mother and father, were very active in the club. In fact, they had been there not too many days before to a dinner before they were killed. And there were the Nafzigers from the journalism department. Of course, Grant Hyde and Helen Patterson, who were married in their later life, were both professors of journalism, and they were extremely active. Helen Patterson did a lot of the publicity for our club. We generally had a person from the journalism department who would write up our notes that went out to the Capital Times, to the State Journal, and would write up our calendar for the month.
Did they just do this on a volunteer basis? Or
just for a token fee, yeah. Like $100 a year or something like that.
That's not much. That,
no, it isn't, huh? But it was just something. We had a man who was an instructor, I think, at one time, who lived in the club, and who did it for a while. He wrote an article that appeared in one of the magazines, Money Makes the Mare Go, on a horse racing. He always told me that if I ever wanted to write a story about the club and the people in it, he would ghostwrite it for me, but unfortunately he died many years ago. Bob Knorr was the chairman of the physical ed department. He was over there an awful lot. And Gaines Post was another person who enjoyed the club. And Alfred Peterson, Al Peterson, who was one of the vice presidents, was very active in the club. He and his wife always came to quite many of the dances, dinners.
How about presidents?
Well, I didn't know too many of them very well, but I knew Dr. Fred quite well. He came to the club frequently. He liked being down there. Mrs. Fred was very active in everything at the club. And I know that she and Mary Farley were, I think, the two people who were instrumental in starting what they called a Young People's Assembly, which was a dance at Christmas time. And this went on for several years. And it was very exclusive. Everyone who came was screened before they came. If they, the members' children or grandchildren could come, but if they brought guests, they generally had to know who they were. In those days, everything was very exclusive. But I don't know how many years they had it, but later on it got to be not as much fun as people going to hotels and having parties where there was lots more excitement. Mm-hmm. Wonder if there's anything more on social events that we could think of. We had a lot of art exhibits in the dining room from year to year, or month to month, I should say, which were very nice. Most of them were from people on the faculty who had art exhibits or etchings, even buttons sometimes. There were lots of button exhibits down there. And one time we had an exhibit from somebody in Chicago, and I think his works are at the Albion Art Center now,